Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Today we speak with Ruben Martinez, an award-winning journalist, musician, college professor, and author of Desert America, where he writes of his move to the Espanola Valley, a, quote, world of outrageous wealth and devastating poverty. Ruben Martinez, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
I'd like to begin with the overall themes of your book and then talk about your time in northern New Mexico, where your wife-to-be could research the historical dimensions of drug addiction and you believed you could secretly get clean. What an interesting relationship dynamic. But let's start with the general themes. Why the title, Desert America?
Changes in the West, as it's lived today, the demographic and political changes over the last generation, which have been huge, including the browning of the West, let's say, in terms of, you know, the explosion of the Latino population due to immigration, the browning of its tongue, the way Spanish is heard in the West, the immigration debate, the way it's been played out in the West vis-a-vis Arizona currently, and the way that the Great Recession played itself out in the West, writ super large, in other words, the biggest foreclosure, you know, rates in the nation, the highest unemployment rates in the nation. The West tells the United States, tells America about itself. It has for a long time, and this, the experience of the West during the Great Recession, is really kind of like, you know, the one in the 99 personified. So we're trying to say, if you want, you want to see where the country's at, just take a look at everything west of the 100th meridian.
One of the things you write about are the restorative powers of the West. Do you think those powers have been dulled by the Great Recession?
I think it's yes and no. I certainly went to the West on a restorative pilgrimage. As you alluded to earlier, I was suffering addiction, drug addiction, when I arrived. And I found some semblance of cleanness in the desert in fits and starts over a period of many years. And along the way, I became aware of just how deep the roots of desert as metaphor for that kind of healing pilgrimage go. I didn't necessarily, you know, understand that when I first arrived.
Yeah, but I'm not really sure what you mean by that.
Well, in terms of people heading out into the desert to heal themselves, that literature goes back a couple, at least a couple millennia.
Yes.
You could go, you know, the 4th century desert fathers retiring from the Nile River Valley, basically dropping out and tuning in, turning off, and going out into the desert, into their desert monastic cells, and basically trying to purge themselves of the demons, as they called them back then, which today we could call, you know, addiction, you know, demons by another name, right? Or you could talk about the consumptives of the 19th century, you know, being told, go west, go to the cleaner, drier air, you know. The desert west as a site of healing has very, very deep roots, not just in this region, but in terms of the way humans regard the desert across history. And I was only dimly aware of that as I began my journey into the desert over the years. I just saw how many people, I mean, whether it's you go to Ojo Caliente, you know, to get those mineral baths going, whether you go to see the sweep of the vista off the Marfa Plain, you know, the Big Bend region, or the otherworldly landforms in Joshua Tree, California, people go out there to basically clear their head, cleanse their body, and I believe that still exists. Has it been dulled by the crisis of the last generation in the desert, by the, you know, the flip side of it, the tensions, the political tensions, the devastating poverty, the divide in terms of income inequality? Yes, I believe it has. I mean, a part of the desert is a place where there is blood soaking into the sand, the migrants crossing the desert and dying crossing it. So the desert is a fraught place. We know it's got extremes in temperature and extremes in terms of scarcity of water. Well, it's got social and political extremes as well, and we're living them today as much as any other time in history.
I'd like to move to your move to northern New Mexico, to a place called Velarde, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And could we start with you just telling us where exactly that is?
It's on the low road, quote-unquote, to Taos. Highway 68 that basically begins at the 84, 285 as you're going north from Santa Fe towards Taos. If you stay straight on that road, you can turn onto the 68 and you can just go straight. So if your listeners have gone to Taos on that low road on the 68 to Taos, you have passed through Velarde.
I had never noticed Velarde.
And the reason, and there's two reasons for that. One is a kind of geographical, and another, I would argue, is kind of political in a way. Number one, the 68 itself is the bed of the road is raised in that particular part of the valley, mm-hmm. and so the town is kind of hidden. You know, it's also a tiny, tiny town. If you blink, you miss it. It's 800 people that live there. But it's also because it's obscured by the geography of the region. It's also how big the landscape is up there. You know, it's a pretty dramatic landscape.
It is.
Just before the Taos Gorge, and it's right along the Black Mesa, which begins essentially, you know, just north of Española and lasts all the way to the opening of the canyon that becomes the Taos Gorge. So Velarde sits right in the shadow of the Black Mesa. So if you look west from the road as you're going up, you're not going to notice the village. The first thing you're going to notice is the imposing landscape. And as I argue in the book, this is something that is pretty common in the West. We're intoxicated with the landscape. We paint it. We film it. We write odes to it, poems and songs, and we're awed by it. It's part of the tourist draw. You know, it's part of what draws Easterners and West of the West people, you know, to live there. It certainly drew me. That awe-inspiring vista tends to diminish or obscure or render invisible the human presence on the landscape. So it's kind of like the Western capital W, you know, John Ford, you know, the way it's captured that way, or
absolutely,
the landscapes,
yeah.
The great painters, Taos or Santa Fe art colonies.
Yeah, Blumenschein.
That's Blumenschein, Moran, right. You know, O'Keeffe, of course. Those images are what we have. It's fantastic art, don't get me wrong. I love it. We all do. It's part of our great American legacy of art in the West. But it also tends to wallpaper over the social realities on the ground. And that's a lot of what the book is preoccupied
with. True. And I think one of the really interesting things that you personify these themes, and one of the ways you personify the theme of dispossession is with a story about one of your neighbors who used to actually live in the house that you end up renting. I wonder if you could tell us that story.
I became obsessed with the idea of neighbors and what they mean in the literal sense, like the people next door to you, how you're responsible to them, how they're responsible to you, what the relationship of neighbors really is in an ethical sense. Because when we lived in Velarde, we had several neighbors. We had a little cluster of adobes just off the Rio Grande. And the first neighbor I met was right next door. His name is Joe Rendon. He told me within minutes of meeting him that all the land in the area belonged to his family, going back something like 10, 11 generations, which is a pretty typical thing for a Norteño or Hispano, you know, family to tell you. You know, there's plenty of families that to this day are fighting over the legacy of the land grants and the water rights that go along with the acequia system up north. That still makes news in New Mexico, right?
It does. So
he told me that all this land belonged to the Rendones, as he said. So he said to me, "You don't live in Velarde. You live in Los Rendones." And I said, "Wow, yeah." And I said, so where did you grow up?" And he said, "Well, I grew up in the house that you're in now." It stopped me cold. I mean, there was a long beat of silence before I knew how to what do you say, you know, in a situation like that. And I said, "Well, you should come over, man." Is what I stammered, I think, finally. And he said, "No, not yet. I'm not ready yet." And then he turned away. And you know, we became good neighbors, but it took him 3 years for him to be ready to come over and to walk inside the house that he grew up in and which the family had sold off at a certain point. And that is also, you know, a big part of New Mexico and Western history across time, since the American occupation at least. The families have deeded the original land grants, how those land grants have been chipped away by chicanery, by infeuding among the families themselves, you know, some wanting to sell off, some wanting to hold on, the complicated legacy of the Mexican-American War, and how it still reverberates today. I mean, when my neighbor Joe Rendon told me, "You're living in my house," it wound time back to the Mexican-American War.
Let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're talking with the author today of a book called Desert America, and we're talking about the portion of the book where Ruben Martinez writes about northern New Mexico in a place called Velarde. And one of the themes of your book is I guess I would call an anti-gentrification theme. I mean, the book is an interesting book because it's sort of part memoir, part critique, part reporting, and part really history. So I guess what I want to take on is the critique part, because you seem to be very negative on gentrification, but I happen to live in Chicago and maybe was part of the gentrification that really sort of revitalized Chicago. It revitalized the area around the central city, and Boston had something like that. And the cities that haven't had that, like, say, Detroit or Buffalo or Cleveland, their central areas have died. And so, you know, I tend to think of gentrification as more like a normal cellular growth. So, you know, our cells die too, right? And they're reborn. Don't cities and places kind of have to do this, or they'll die?
Yes, that part of the argument is well taken. That point is very well taken, indeed. We could look at most of the major cities in the United States, and a lot of world capitals that have undergone rounds of gentrification over the last generation, and people go to the Riverwalk in San Antonio, and you could call that a part of, you know, urban renewal / gentrification. The neighborhoods I grew up in, Los Angeles. So yes, I mean, places that are declining because of jobs being lost, a way of life being lost, population decline, et cetera. Don't we want those places to come back in one shape or form or another? Absolutely we do. There's a particular kind of gentrification, though, that we see in the West, in which the renewal comes at the expense of a native population. And when I say native, I don't mean necessarily just indigenous Americans, native first peoples. I'm talking whoever was there before us, the newcomers, arrived.
Yeah, and here you talk specifically about Hispanos.
Absolutely, absolutely. So in this case, my wife Angela and I, arriving there, were the gentrifiers. And when I take up residence in that house, and he tells me, you're living in my house, essentially. I'm living in a trailer next door. You're living in the beautiful adobe that I grew up in, but that was sold off by my aunt, or I can't remember the exact lineage of how it left the family's hands. But in that context, my presence maybe raises the property tax base a little bit. Maybe there's some positive ripples because of that. But there's also negative ones. I'm taking up a space that belonged to somebody else, that there's a history to, that's connected to colonial history unavoidably. And what if the real estate market really starts getting hot because they see that a couple of writers have moved into the neighborhood and
the bohos move in, and then there's some buzz, and then the real estate speculators start speculating, and then
property values start to go up.
Right.
And our last experience of this in the 2000s, of course, pushed us over a cliff. The real estate market was too hot. The speculation was beyond speculation. It was unscrupulous. And, of course, we know about the toxic loans and the enabling of all kinds of scandalous, extreme capitalism. And the West knows this very well. I mean, the Santa Fe Ring. Let's talk about the OG gentrifiers. We know their names. They're right there in Santa Fe, on the plaza. Thomas Catron, former governor. What I'm saying is that urban renewal projects are one thing. Radical gentrification and unscrupulous real estate speculation is a different kind of wheel.
What I'd like to do, Ruben, is sort of move on to sort of the reason for your move to Velarde. And
sure.
That was that your wife-to-be, Angela Garcia is her name, I believe.
Yes.
And she was going to do her dissertation on sort of the historical dimensions of drug addiction. And you couldn't have picked a better place than the Espanola Valley, because New Mexico leads the nation in drug addiction, drug overdoses, both by heroin and by prescription drugs. And she wanted to sort of see firsthand why this came about and how this came about. So you move there. And again, you personify the presence of drugs and the availability of drugs with another neighbor. And I understand you've prepared a reading about that.
These are our other neighbors just across the way from the Joe Rendon, the Garcias, and we're literally, you know, within 100 feet of, you know, their property line, right, when we're in our house. And as soon as we moved in, we heard them. We didn't see them. We didn't meet them right away, but we heard them because they were having these incredibly loud fights. And it became pretty clear to us that it was, well, not just dysfunction, but other things were going on. So I'll pick up the reading right there. they are dealing. We've noticed the traffic. Perhaps a dozen cars a day drive through. These customers are men, all Hispanos, young and old, mostly in work trucks. Some will come early in the morning, apparently on the way to a trade job. Others in the early evening, clearly after finishing work. Some in the middle of the day, some in the wee hours. It's Rose's house. The Garcias are as prominent in the area as the Rendones. One member of the clan owns the nightclub in the village. Another, the fruit stand that's never open at the intersection of the highway with the Leiden Road. The Garcias, I am told, are an old, connected family. So well-connected that our landlady passed on to us advice she was given by local law enforcement when she suspected that Jose had stolen her lawnmower. We can't do anything to them, the cops told her. But if you want to take action on your own, shoot him, drag him into your house, and make it look like self-defense against breaking and entering. So all Angela and I can do is really watch and listen through the screens on the attic windows. The journalist in me thinks, talk to them, get close. But we already are. They are our neighbors. So for a period of months of adjusting to our arrival in Velarde, we come to an agreement, all of us. They won't get in our stuff, and we won't get in theirs, which means we must not feel compassion or loathing or fear. We must not feel anything for each other. But still, I go to the window in the attic.
Thank you for the reading. I want to ask you some questions about it. But first, let me just mention that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the phone with me Ruben Martinez, who's the author of Desert America. You've just heard him read a paragraph or two from his book. And I guess the question for me was always, when I first came to New Mexico, was why New Mexico? I mean, it's not the crumbling urban dwellings and the, you know, the hopelessness that you think of with an inner city, but New Mexico still leads the nation with this problem. And there are the, you know, the obvious explanations. We're sort of right near the drug plaza in Juarez.
Right.
There's a lot of poverty. There's, you know, not a lot of education. But it seems to me that what I really found interesting about your book is you seem to go behind that, and you seem to talk about the historical and cultural reasons for it. And so I ask you to talk about
sure.
that.
Sure. Yeah. It's a profound question. All the reasons that you cited are part of the mix. And I was very much influenced by Angela, my wife, Angela Garcia, anthropologist, now at Stanford University, who was studying addiction and really was studying her own family in a way, obliquely, because her family's from in the South Valley, Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, that's the other big drug center, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So Angela didn't literally want to study her own family. That would have been too weird. Even for an anthropologist are generally told to study other people, not their own
people.
Yeah,
only psychologists study their own family.
Right. So she chose a village in New Mexico, but up the road. And Velarde, in many ways, is kind of like the South Valley of northern New Mexico, or the Española Valley, rather. You know, it's the South Valley. They mirror each other in many ways. Angela really came to her answer to this problem, really, I came to agree with it profoundly. She says that there is a melancholy, a kind of depression on this land that has to do with what how we were talking about my neighbor and how he was looking at my adobe from his trailer while I was living there. It's a landscape of loss. It's a landscape that is stunning to the outsider. Think of Ansel Adams' world-famous photograph, Moonrise Hernandez.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, the drive between Santa Fe and Taos, I'm sure almost everyone in New Mexico has taken it. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful things you'll ever see.
Absolutely. It's beautiful. And it's a place that was lost. In other words, grazing permits were lost. The actual land grants were lost, the acequias, the water rights. The Santa Fe and the Carson National Forests, over 2 million acres of land, used to belong to somebody. So when the people and the descendants of the people that lost that land and landscape still live there. So when they look out on that landscape, they're not seeing it the way we do. They're not seeing it like Ansel Adams or Blumenshine or Moran or Hartley. They're seeing it through an experience of historical, political, economic loss. And since also, by the way, this population is overrepresented in our military, as is most working class people in the country, right, are overrepresented in the military. The Hispanos of northern New Mexico are like that. They were overrepresented in terms of their numbers, serving overseas in Vietnam. Most people trace the severe drug problem that we see today in the Española Valley to the experience of service members coming back from Vietnam with drug habits. So just add, you know, more salt onto the wound, right, in terms of how the genealogy of this depression that makes one vulnerable to just wanting to get high, to get away from it, you know, to just stop seeing the ghosts.
And this is passed on from generation to generation, you think?
Absolutely. And once again, I have to cite Angela's work on this because it's incredibly important in her field of medical anthropology. She wrote a book called The Pastoral Clinic about her experience up there. We both wrote books, you know, in our time up there. And hers describes this landscape of loss, as does mine. You know, we just do it through different lenses, you know, as writers. But ultimately, we felt it. You know, we were surrounded by this.
Yeah, so I want to get to the personal. If I get too personal,
sure,
you tell me. But as I said, your book seems to say that you kind of secretly wanted to go to Velarde to get clean yourself, and you hadn't really told Angela that this was part of your reason. And so it must have been, number one, very difficult for you to do that with drugs omnipresent, and they're cheap and they're pure.
Yep.
And you've got this problem.
Well, as anyone who's watched an episode of Breaking Bad knows, trying to keep drugs a secret, whether you're producing them or using them, takes a tremendous amount of energy. And you learn to, you know, compartmentalize your life and tell all kinds of lies and hide things under the bed, sometimes literally, as I did in Velarde, or figuratively. And at a certain point, you start to believe your own lies. You know, you can compartmentalize yourself so perfectly well that you live the illusion that the person that's, you know, having breakfast with, like, you know, me having breakfast with Angela on a beautiful spring day in Velarde, that's one reality completely separate from the addict that's waiting for Angela to leave, you know, to see her mother for a weekend so that addict can get high. And that's essentially what happened on that landscape. So I was veering in and out of kind of like these selves, but the addict really kind of like was really the conductor of the orchestra ultimately, because at the end of the day, he was going to call the shots. And that process lasted throughout our time in Velarde, and I did keep it a secret from Angela until after we left Velarde. She didn't find out about it until I told her, "You're about to read something in my book that you don't know about," and that's when she read it.
So I'm sure everybody wants to know, how did she react?
She was shocked, but not surprised. I think
she sounds like a generous person.
Well, by the time that I revealed this to her, we were already on a fast track to becoming the proud parents of our twin daughters, Ruby and Lucia. So, you know, the train left the station in a lot of different ways, and I was clean. Ruby and Lucia having a lot to do with that. You know, earlier we were talking about the idea of renewal in the West and how it happens. Well, the biggest renewal in my life was the birth of my twin daughters. And that, as much as any other change in my life, has helped me to stay on the clean path ever
well,
since.
Well, I guess I would say congratulations. And let me just move on to one final little thing here, because we're nearing the end of the show.
Okay.
And I'd like to sort of return to the general themes that we talked about to begin with, but really focus them on the Española Valley. You know, where do you see the Española Valley going in the future? I mean, there's been it's had a setback along with the rest of the country. But I always hasten to point out that the United States is growing faster than any other developed country. But
yes.
But still, we're not growing that fast, and Española certainly isn't. Valley isn't growing that fast. So where do you see that part of the state of New Mexico going in the future?
The flip side of the dark, depressing story, the landscape of loss story, the drug addiction story of northern New Mexico is the fact that northern New Mexico, for several generations, has had a tradition of political resistance, radical and progressive and liberal. Take your pick. There's all shades of left in northern New Mexico. But some of the most inspiring political movements of the Desert West come from northern New Mexico. The last armed uprising against the federal government took place in northern New Mexico, Andres Lopez Tijerina. And we're still hearing the echoes from that up there. If you go up there and talk to some of the old-timers, they'll still argue about the significance of that. The people who hold on to their water rights, the acequia system, the people that still organize around the land grants, the people that still hold the commons of the land grants sacred, the people who fight with the Forest Service bureaucracy to open up the forest, the small prescriptions for sustainable logging for communities to sustain themselves in northern New Mexico. All these issues, there are people organizing, and there have been for generations. And on that side of the tally, I think you see northern New Mexico not just surviving, but it's opened its path towards the future. The heroin problem, the drug problem, is a huge one, and there's some organizing energy around it. But I think a lot of people also throw up their hands because the problem seems so entrenched. You know, it's clearly the most depressing thing on that landscape. I think that the future of Española depends on taking that tremendous political energy that exists up there and harnessing it to address the drug problem. Some of that energy has already been directed in that direction, but there needs to be more.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank my guest so much, Ruben Martinez, the author of Desert America. Thanks also to my producer, Joe Green. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. Podcasts of this and other locally produced shows can be found at KUNM.org. Archives of all my prior shows can be found at stephenspitz.com and are downloadable at iTunes and searchable under Stephen Spitz. Thank you for listening. See you next time.